Allied forces. The senior Syrian lawmaker told Iran's Tasnim news agency, "What just happened is highly dangerous. Washington is keeping up its act of aggression to advance the interests of the regime in occupied Palestine." The senior Syrian lawmaker Faisal Ahmad added, "The attack will not undermine the iron resolve of Syria and its allies to drive American occupiers out of Syrian soil, but will rather strengthen the Syrian nation's determination to strengthen its role in the resistance axis and to confront Western and global arrogance." Thursday, Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif spoke to his Syrian counterpart, Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad, on the telephone. The two officials emphasized the need for Western countries to abide by UN Security Council resolutions regarding Syria. The Iranian foreign minister Zarif reaffirmed Iran's support for the Syrian nation in its effort to rid the country of terrorist groups, many of which have the support of US military in their campaign of destruction. Meanwhile, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, an ally of Syria, said on Friday, 26th of February, that the United States had notified Moscow of the impending attack on the Popular Mobilization Unit facility 4 or 5 minutes ahead of the actual attack. Sergei Lavrov said, "Our military was warned 4 or 5 minutes ahead of time, of course, even if we are talking about deconfliction, as is customary in ties between Russia and US military personnel, this is nothing. This was a kind of notification where the strike was already being carried out." The Russian foreign minister said the US military is present on Syrian soil illegally in violation of all norms of international law, including Security Council resolutions on reconciliation in Syria. He said Russia had received unconfirmed information that the US is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. Sergei Lavrov added, "We have recently received various information from various sources. We cannot confirm it for now and want to ask the Americans about this directly. Supposedly, they are making the decision to never leave Syria, even to the point of destroying the country." The Russian Foreign Ministry under Lavrov also condemned the US airstrike, urging the Americans to respect Syria's territorial integrity. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova told reporters, "We strongly condemn such actions and call for Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity to be unconditionally respected." Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry also reacted to the US airstrikes, warning against any action that will further complicate the situation in the Middle East. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman, Wang Wenbin, at a press briefing on Friday, 26th of February, said, "China calls on all relevant parties to respect Syria's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity." The United States began its military intervention in Syria with the emergence of the Daesh terrorist group in 2014, when Washington and its allies formed a military coalition under the pretext of fighting the terrorist group. In parallel, Washington also deployed its own military forces and equipment in Syria as part of its unilateral so-called anti-terror campaign. The US and its allies did nothing to uproot Daesh terrorists and even worked hand-in-hand with Daesh terrorists on occasions to hinder Syrian army operations, which were backed by both Iran and Russia, against the terrorist group. Daesh terrorists suffered defeat in Syria in late 2017, but the United States refused to end its unlawful military presence in the country, which has neither a United Nations authorization nor the consent of the government in Damascus. Washington even began to strengthen its foothold in eastern Syria and northeastern parts of the country, which is rich in oil. The Deir al-Zor province in Syria, where a large part of Syria's oil reserves are located, currently hosts America's most notorious military base in the Arab country, which is widely reported to be used by Washington to train the remnants of the Daesh terrorist group and various other terrorist outfits operating against the Syrian government. The US-controlled region also serves as a safe route for Daesh terrorists to freely move across the border from Syria into neighboring Iraq and vice versa. Russia once said the Tanf region of eastern Syria had become a black hole which Daesh terrorists used to carry out attacks against Syrian government forces and Syrian civilians.
Africa Today.
Most Western multinationals continue to exploit poor African countries by paying less tax while making abnormal profits. They often transfer the proceeds to their country of origin. Now, this has led to a massive increase in illicit financial flows, and Africa is losing billions of dollars. Let's listen here to Amina Mohammed, the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, on how Africa is losing a colossal amount of money through these illicit financial flows.
At a time when Africa is trying to maximize domestic resource mobilization, it's losing $50 billion a year to illicit flows. And that probably is not an estimate that is anywhere near the reality.
We have a lot in store for you till the end of our show today, so stay tuned. And thanks for making Press TV your channel of choice.
Who's stealing Africa's cash? The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, recently released its flagship Economic Development in Africa Report 2020, titled Tackling Financial Flows for Substantial Development in Africa. The report shows that every year, an estimated $88.6 billion, which is equivalent to 3.7% of Africa's GDP, leaves the continent in the form of illicit financial flows. Illicit financial flows are movements of money and assets across borders which are illegal in source, transfer, or use. The source of this cash is mainly corruption, criminal activities, tax evasion, and transfer mispricing.
The report by United Nations Conference on Trade and Development includes alarming information on how Africa loses billions of dollars yearly as a result of these illicit financial flows. It also highlights the impact of such losses on the development of the continent. UNCTAD Secretary General Mokhisa Kitui says illicit financial flows rob Africa and its people of their prospects.
Countries with the high illicit financial flows are demonstrably less productive in agriculture than those with more control on illicit financial flows. Countries with high illicit financial flows invest about 25% less in health, 58% less in education than comparable countries on the continent.
The UNCTAD report has mentioned some examples of illicit financial flows. For instance, Angola lost $60 billion through capital flight between 1986 and 2015. In Nigeria, oil export misinvoicing cost the country $44 billion, and import misinvoicing led to a loss of $45 billion between 1996 and 2014. Zambia's net export misinvoicing of copper led to losses amounting to $14.5 billion from 1995 to 2014.
Addressing a high-level virtual meeting last December, the UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohamed said, at a time when Africa is mobilizing resources for pandemic recovery and sustainable development, illicit financial flows are robbing the continent billions of dollars. Let's take a listen.
At a time when Africa is trying to maximize domestic resource mobilization, it's losing $50 billion a year to illicit flows. And that probably is not an estimate that is anywhere near the reality. These staggering losses would be enough to fill 75% of the continent's health financing gap. They would more than be what is needed to achieve the Sustainable Development Goal on Inclusive Education, SDG 4. And they are one-third of what Africa needs annually to fund infrastructure projects.
Now, for more on these, we contacted Peter Fabricius, who is a consultant to the Institute for Security Studies. We also have Dr. Carlotta Schuster, an economist with the Division for Africa and Least Developed Countries at the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. She's also one of the authors of the UNCTAD report on tackling financial flows for sustainable development in Africa. Thanks a lot for your time. Let's start off with Dr. Schuster. Now, can you briefly elaborate on the report you co-authored?
First of all, let me thank you for giving the opportunity to speak about UNCTAD's research on illicit financial flows. In the report, we define illicit financial flows as cross-border flows of money or goods that are illicit in origin, transfer, and use. Since extractive commodities matter for the continent, as they constitute more than 60% of total African exports and 30% of GDP, getting returns right is crucial for fostering sustainable development. The report estimates that the continent has lost at least $220 billion linked to the export of extractive commodities since 2010, and that high-value, low-weight commodities like gold, diamonds, and platinum are the main drivers.
Thanks for that introduction, Dr. Schuster. Now, how have these illicit financial flows impacted on ability by countries to combat poverty and develop?
Illicit financial flows are a global problem, but socioeconomic costs are especially high in Africa. Countries with high illicit financial flows spend on average 58% less on education and 25% less on health. In some countries, illicit financial flows linked to the extraction of natural resources have an unquantifiable multiplier effect, where they undermine peace and security and finance conflict, which is extremely costly in terms of people's prosperity, poverty reduction, and sustainable development.
Thanks for that, Dr. Schuster from the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development.
According to iWatch Africa website, multinational tech companies such as Google and Facebook operating legally across Africa pay substantially lower taxes as a result of obsolete tax rules. Why are African countries not doing enough to stop or reduce illicit financial flows which take place by exploiting local legal loopholes?
It's difficult because a lot of these tax practices are not illegal. And I mean, you know, the OECD and the G20 and so on have been working quite hard to make them illegal, or at least to discourage governments from doing that. And they're having some success, but clearly not enough, because I think a lot of foreign jurisdictions derive too much profit from them. A lot of little, you know, tax haven countries, territories of Britain or US or whatever, sort of depend quite heavily on them. And then, of course, there's just corruption. You know, I mean, there's guilt on both sides.
As you mentioned there, cash stolen from Africa mostly ends up in Western financial institutions. Now, why is enough action not being taken by the United States and major European governments to stop their territories from being a destination of these illicit financial flows?
But they're clearly not enough. You know, the Panama Papers and so on have shown that there's still a huge amount of money that is moving clandestinely, at the very least, if not blatantly illegally. from all over the world. But let's say we're talking about Africa, from Africa and other developing parts of the world to I guess largely to banks in the developed world. And so it's clearly something that's difficult to combat because it's profitable to a lot of banks and a lot of jurisdictions. And so, you know, sustained effort is needed to combat it.
As we saw earlier in the program, Nigeria is among the African countries mostly affected by illicit financial flows. The country is currently ranked 146 out of 180 countries in the 2019 Corruption Perceptions Index. War on Corruption has not achieved a significant milestone in the overall prevention of corruption in the country. The country's Vice President, Oluyemi Osinbajo, last year warned that the illicit financial flows out of Africa also undermine the foundations of democracy.
They undermine the foundations of democracy and provide the financial incentives for terrorist activities and fuel conflicts on the continent.
Mr. Fabricius, you earlier mentioned that illicit financial flows are a two-way traffic and that some African officials are involved. How can you elaborate?
You looked at some of the reports that have been done by other institutions like the late Kofi Annan's institution a few years ago, where what was happening in a country like the DRC, and I don't know if it still is, the Democratic Republic of Congo, where what was happening is that, the state-owned enterprises, often mining enterprises, were selling off their minerals at ridiculously low prices to private entrepreneurs who were then selling them on to, you know, at the real market value. And clearly what was happening there was that those private business people, foreign business people mostly, I guess, were giving huge kickbacks to people in government, including probably right up to the top, you know.
What needs to be done to end these illicit financial flows?
This is a very good question. The Economic Development in Africa report proposes a 10-point plan to tackle illicit financial flows. At the national level, better customs enforcement, better geological information, and increased transparency around resource contracts will allow to increase revenue. At the regional level, information sharing between countries and unifying markets through the African Continental Free Trade Agreement is another avenue that allows countries to exert their power in international commodity markets. At the international level, better cooperation on international taxation and reducing harmful tax competition between countries allows to curb illicit financial flows further. Illicit financial flows are a shared problem between developed and developing countries, and curbing them requires global solutions.
Mr. Fabricius, you have the last one. Western countries clearly need to take measures to stop their jurisdictions from being used as a haven for looted African cash. On the other side of the coin, what should African governments do to tackle this problem of illicit financial flows?
Is that African countries have to improve their ability to conduct revenue collection at home. Very few African countries actually have efficient and capable tax administrations. You know, in a way, this continent has become so addicted, if you like, or habituated to foreign aid that it just hasn't had the motivation in many cases.
Tackling corruption and functional revenue collection are key factors in tackling illicit financial flows in Africa.
U.S. dumps e-waste in Africa.
E-waste is used electronic items that are nearing the end of their useful life and are discarded or given to be recycled. The rapid modernization, industrialization, and consumer appetite for better products has exacerbated e-waste management challenges. Several African countries have become the world's largest dumping grounds for electronic waste from Western countries. This e-waste dumping has created a deadly industry that has put thousands at risk.
If I see different way, this one is we are suffering for here because the heat is there. And where the smoke is, they disturb us. So if you see good work, we will go join it and leave this one.
E-waste dumping is actually a continuation of waste colonialism, where high GDP Western countries in Europe and North America were accessing African land for inexpensive disposal of waste. They were using Africa and primarily countries in the Gulf of Guinea, especially Nigeria, Ghana, and Ivory Coast, as a dump for their toxic waste.
For an incisive analysis on this, we have contacted Nimo Basay, an environmental activist, author, and director of Health of Mother Earth Foundation. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Our first question, now despite all the hype about protecting the environment, it appears Western countries do not really care for others, as they are now dumping electronic waste in Africa. What's your take?
Unfortunately, when it comes to environmental health and dumping of waste around the world, Africa is seen basically as a dumping site. So Africa usually is seen as a storehouse for exploitation, but it's also seen as a place to dump waste. And the act of dumping toxic waste in Africa, e-waste in Africa, is not accidental. It's actually economically propelled. It's also a deliberate political action. In 1991, a chief economist in the World Bank said that it made economic sense to dump toxic waste in Africa because Africa is vastly under-polluted. When we have that line of thinking at that level of global governance, then we can see that what is happening across the continent is a very deliberate act, and it needs a deliberate pushback.
Thanks for that, Nimo Basay, environmental activist from Nigeria, and stay tuned for more.
From the start of this country, we haven't had really any answer for the electronic waste that we produce. Talk less of the electronic waste that gets dumped on us from outside.
Why have most governments in the Gulf of Guinea region failed to stop their territories from being used as dumping ground for hazardous waste?
The sad situation is that some of our regulators are not really focused on what they ought to be doing, and they get carried away by other things, and they're not paying attention to ensuring that the environment is not damaged this way. We have regulators who believe that accepting some of these waste is kind of economically viable. It brings some resources into the country. They're looking for how to generate revenue, and they keep a blind eye to the dumping of these dangerous e-waste on the continent, especially Nigeria and Ghana, as you mentioned.
Speaking at the launch of our National Integrated E-Waste Management Program in 2018, President Nana Akufo-Addo of Ghana noted that the downside of the ICT revolution has meant the production of high volumes of electronic and electrical wastes.
E-waste is a major global problem and one of the top environmental challenges of this, our 21st century. Indeed, many of the ICT equipment imported into the country, as we say in Ghana, are secondhand. Most of these products are imported illegally in contravention of regional and international laws, such as the Bamako Convention, the Basel Convention, and EU waste shipment regulations. It is in line with this responsibility that the Hazardous and Electronic Waste Control and Management Act, Act 917 of 2016, has been passed. Today's launch, ladies and gentlemen, marks the initiation of two key provisions of Act 917, which are critical to the successful implementation of this new law.
According to the UN Environment Agency, Nigeria now ranks alongside Ghana as one of the world's leading destinations for electronic waste. The country receives 71,000 tons of used consumer goods through the two main ports in Lagos from the European Union and other more industrialized economies every year. Nigeria is an attractive destination for waste exporters, partly due to the limited enforcement of import restrictions and other regulations. Do we have adequate international regulations to stop e-waste dumping in Africa?
Again, as is usual with many environmental issues, sometimes it's not really the lack of regulation that makes it impossible to take care of the environment. It's actually a lack of willingness to protect the environment and protect the people. We have in Africa, for example, the Bamako Treaty, which ought to be endorsed by every country. I'm not quite certain if Nigeria has endorsed as at this time. As at last year, late 2019, they hadn't endorsed it. This is a treaty that would have protected the country from dumping of toxic waste. But
Ghana is said to have the largest informal recycling industry in Africa and imports some 40,000 tons of e-waste annually. There are several homegrown initiatives in the country to deal with the e-waste problem. A social entrepreneur and artist, together with his friends, have been turning e-waste from the sprawling dumping ground in Ghana's capital Accra into high-end furniture made by the people working in the dump.
It's true that Abubakar is the result of negative externalities from, you know, dumping by more developed European countries, but I chose to see the opportunity within the mess. You know, I chose to see the opportunity to create and turn what has been called a dump into an opportunity.
Still in Ghana, an NGO known as the Green Advocacy is working to improve the situation for workers at the e-waste site with machinery that strips the wires of their kerosene.
So since 2009, we had this idea of setting up some kind of pilot recycling center to help the people here stop burning. So a customer comes in with a piece of cable, we just take it through this end, it goes the other way, we get the plastic, they take their metal. So it's like really fast, no issues, you just walk in, you pay your 50 pesos, that's it.
While such initiatives are an artistic way of solving this e-waste problem, they quite clearly cannot provide a lasting and substantial solution to the challenge posed by this hazardous waste. What immediate action needs to be taken to save Africa from further dumping of hazardous waste by former colonial powers?
I believe the first step is actually to decolonize the continent. We're still running a new colonial system that listens too much to the former colonial masters. And this overbearing influence of the colonial powers, the imperialist powers on the African political system. And then, of course, we need to fight against poverty.
Mr. Basu there believes that Africa needs to eradicate neocolonialism to stop the destruction of the continent's environment and preserve it for future generations. What do you think? Do let us know your views through our social media handles. That's all we had for you in today's edition. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, thank you for being with us. Take care and God bless you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The debate.
U.S. President Joe Biden ordered military airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. The military action, the first of its kind under U.S. President Joe Biden, has been met with negative reactions, with many observers likening Biden's approach to that of his hawkish predecessor, Donald Trump. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. Iran has repeatedly rejected any role in the attacks targeting American bases in Iraq. Iraqi resistance forces have been fighting remnants of the Takfiri-Daesh terror group across border regions of Iraq and Syria in coordination with the governments in both Arab countries. Damascus has censured the U.S. air raid, describing it as cowardly and a bad sign from the new U.S. administration. For more on that story, we're joined by our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who's with us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Mohammed, what more details do you have to share with us and our viewers?
Yes, the Syrian Foreign Ministry issued a statement on this development, saying that Syria strongly condemns what it described as the cowardly U.S. aggression on Deir ez-Zor governorate, particularly areas on the Syrian-Iraqi borderline, warning that the aggression would lead to consequences that escalate the region, the entire region over here. Also, the Foreign Ministry added that the aggression is a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter. The Foreign Ministry statement also said that this aggression is a negative sign of the policies of the new U.S. administration, which should abide by international legitimacy, not by the law of the jungle, according to the statement of the Foreign Ministry. The Foreign Ministry also demanded the United States to change its aggressive policies towards Syria and stop supporting and investing in various terrorist organizations across the Arab country. The Foreign Ministry referred also that recently the United States, U.S. forces in Syria transported hundreds of Daesh terrorists, for example, from prisons under the control of the SDF, the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, to its base, illegal base, of course, in Al-Tanf area on the Syrian-Iraqi borders. It is to be mentioned that the United States' presence is illegal in Syria without a UN mandate, without the authorization of the Syrian government. The United States and the U.S.-led coalition carried out in the past years dozens of airstrikes that killed hundreds of Syrian civilians, destroyed the infrastructure, and also destroyed public and private property. And finally, in the statement, the Foreign Ministry called on the United Nations to shoulder its responsibilities in preserving international peace and security and take swift action to stop one of its permanent member states, which is the United States, from carrying on its crimes and aggression on a sovereign country like Syria.
All right, thanks a lot. Mohammed Ali joining us from Damascus. Our guest for this debate, Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also, we have national co-director, the International Action Center, Ms. Sarah Flounders, joining us from New York. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mr. Kovalik in Pittsburgh. Mr. Kovalik, what does this attack say about U.S. President Joe Biden's approach to foreign policy?
Well, I think it says what many of us feared, and that is that he is going to be a very aggressive president when it comes to military action. you mentioned at the outset of the broadcast, you compared him to his hawkish predecessor, Trump. I'm not sure Trump was any more hawkish than Obama, and I'm not sure Biden will be less hawkish than Trump. My guess is he'll actually be more so. And this is a signal of that. This is an unlawful attack he engaged in. It's illegal under international law. There was no security authorization for it. It wasn't done as an act of self-defense. And it was a war crime. So I think he's signaling, you know, he keeps saying America's back. And what he means by that is the 82nd Airborne is back to start bombing people. And that's a shame.
Sarah Flounders, what do you think is behind the decision to carry out this attack?
Well, I think, as was just said, President Biden is really sending a message that not to expect anything different than previous U.S. presidents in terms of criminal, illegal activity. It's an absolute war crime. I mean, U.S. has no business being in Syria, has no business being in the region at all. They use the flimsiest excuse that's even imaginable, that an Iraqi resistance group backed by Iran, all of this supposed, and for that reason they're bombing Syria. I mean, even here in the U.S., how on earth is that understandable to anyone? But it's saying that the U.S. needs no excuse to continue its intervention. The U.S. has been bombing Syria since 2014, and from the very beginning was part of this effort to bring down Syria, to destroy Syria, to pull it apart. From 2011, a regime change operation is what they called it. And this is Biden signaling that there is no real change in policy. It shows enormous hostility. Also, it's openly said this is to be a message to Iran. It's to be a message to Iraq. It's to a message also to the people here in the U.S. who had expectations about Biden, that maybe he would speak for Amazon workers who are desperately trying to organize a union, more than a million low-wage workers at stake, one warehouse they're organizing. Biden won't say a word. Won't say a word. They're still waiting for a stimulus bill here for millions and millions of people who are desperate. But they could carry out, at enormous expense, a bombing run in Syria. And that is criminal toward the people of Syria, but it's also criminal toward the people here in the U.S. who needed and expected that there would be some change. And of course, there's not.
Daniel, Damascus has censured the U.S. air raid, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new U.S. president. What do you think would be the fallout from this attack?
Well, I think that any chance of the nuclear deal with Iran being put back in place between the U.S. and Iran, I think that's – there was slim hope of that anyway, given Biden's position on that, but I think now that's probably finished. And I think that he, by this bombing, wanted to send the message that there's no rapprochement with Iran coming from him. He sent that message loud and clear, and so, and I'm sure Iran got the message that, again, it's going to be business as usual between the U.S. and Iran, which means sanctions are going to stay in place, which means ordinary Iranians are going to continue to suffer. So that's going to be one fallout. I think a lot of the world, even in Europe, is going to be more wary of the Biden administration. I think there were some amongst world leaders who hoped he would be more diplomatic than Trump, that he would use peaceful means to try to deal with conflicts with other countries. And in fact, Biden, you know, said so, that he would use peaceful means first to deal with other countries. And what he's shown by his actions is he has no intention of doing that. He is going to shoot first and ask questions later.
Sarah Flounders, hours after the U.S. attack, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, along with his Syrian counterpart, they both emphasized the need for Western countries to abide by UN Security Council resolutions regarding Syria. The question is the law. It hasn't really been a concern for Washington, especially when it comes to Syria, has it?
This is so absolutely lawless. There's no concern for even a fig leaf of cover on this, not at all. And we should just keep in mind that the U.S., with no justification, has absolutely made every effort to stop Syria from rebuilding. After these 10 years of hugely destructive war, Syria, at heroic effort, defeated U.S. attempts to overthrow the government. But the sanctions, which would enable absolutely normal trade and rebuilding, are attempting to strangle Syria, as they are attempting to strangle Iran and the whole region, because it shuts down any relations between each of the countries of the region. And that's what it's also meant to do, to push back development, to push back solidarity. And I don't think it's going to have that impact. I think it will, if anything, harden, toughen the resolve in Syria and in Iran, in Iraq too. So the U.S. has shown that their aims, they can be pushed back by people's mobilizations. They have been pushed back. U.S. was literally pushed out of Iraq by millions of people, by real effort, pushed out of Syria. But they keep trying. They really, it's relentless, and it's criminal. And as I say, it has to be the countries of Europe and here in the U.S., which demand a stop of this criminal activity.
Daniel Kovalik,
it shouldn't be only the people of Syria and Iran speaking on this. Really, the people of the whole world need to denounce this.
Let's go over to Pittsburgh again. Daniel Kovalik, the Russian foreign minister, said that the U.S. military is present on Syrian soil illegally and in violation of all norms of international law. China has warned against any action that would further complicate the situation in Syria. An analyst that we spoke to earlier here on Press TV said that Washington might be intending to relaunch the war on Damascus, the one that Biden's old partner Barack Obama started. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that's a great danger. And again, that the Democrats and frankly, the more liberal media, for lack of a better word, have signaled that that's what they want for years. I mean, the Democrats and, outlets like New York Times, NPR, were constantly attacking Trump for every position he took, which is fine. I mean, I have no problem with that. But the one thing they would applaud him for is when he bombed Syria. They were clear that that's what they want, more bombing. They made it clear they didn't want Trump to get out of Afghanistan like he was actually seeming to try to do. So, yeah, I think this is the plan. I think that the goal is to destroy Syria. The U.S. government has on a few occasions acknowledged they cannot overthrow Assad. And so clearly the goal is simply to destroy the country. And now the last figure I saw is you have 12 million Syrians who are starving due to the sanctions, the Caesar sanctions. So I think they are going to continue to sow chaos and destruction in the Middle East. And I say that very sadly, but that's what I see happen.
Sarah Founders, the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, he recently said that Moscow had received unconfirmed information that the United States is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. How inconsistent has the U.S. been in its policy in Syria? Many believe it's impossible to predict whether the U.S. will stay or leave.
Well, the U.S. policy has been consistent in terms of war on the world. And in that, they are signaling that they plan to continue that relentless war. And it is also a war that is absolutely destroying the U.S. We have the highest by every count of deaths from COVID because there is no health infrastructure. There's a huge military infrastructure, They know what's on every one of 800 military bases around the world. They know they can, with their satellites, monitor everything, and yet they can't get out vaccines in the U.S. They can't give emergency supplies in the midst of a horrendous cold snap that's hit Texas and parts of the U.S. South, and people are freezing without electricity, without heat. They can't provide those things. They can't provide the most basic things here for the population. And they can't provide vaccines for the global South, for the people of the world, or the people of the U.S. But they can provide bombs. They can provide destruction, because that is profitable. And that's how they calculate it. They don't calculate it at all with people need peace, and they need health care, and they need good food. Those are absolute human needs. And instead, this policy is set by those who profit from war, and it's enormously profitable, billionaires. So it's destructive, and really those links need to be made more and more so that people here in the U.S. understand who's responsible when they don't have heat or jobs or a vaccine. Who's responsible? This government that cares more about war.
Daniel Kovalik, the attacks in Iraq supposedly against U.S. targets, which have often had little impact, they've escalated over the past year, especially since the Iraqi parliament passed a law that mandated a full withdrawal of all foreign troops from the country. Many are saying that the rise in such activities are apparently aimed at creating a sense of insecurity in Iraq and providing a pretext for the U.S. to keep its troops and forces in the country. Do you see it in that light as well?
Well, yeah, so though it's a strange argument, right, it's a circular argument, to be in a country illegally like the U.S. is, and then to say when, you know, national forces then attack them because they want them out, as we would in the U.S. if someone invaded us and stayed for years, and then to say, well, we have to stay because our presence is causing this reaction, but we have to stay to counter that reaction. It makes no sense, but that is U.S. military policy. We create the crisis, and then we stay to stomp out the crisis or to claim to. It's just completely irrational to any, honest thinking person.
Sarah Founders, I see you nodding there. Would you like to add anything to that?
Well, it's true. Any thinking person would say this is a criminally insane policy, and we're paying with lives in Syria, with lives around the world, and with lives here at all that is not being done in order to continue a war on the world. I just can't say how even disheartening, not that I had any expectation about Biden or the Democratic Party, but there was a certain expectation that there would be maybe even some breathing room, or that there would be some attention to the needs here. But it's really clear that they intend to keep military presence every single place they can, and to expand it, to threaten other countries. And so when Biden sends a message like this, we got to take it seriously and up the demands here, because that is the only way I can see, and to absolutely state how there's no excuse. We have to make this completely unacceptable, and to demand they end the sanctions and the bases and the bombings and the war on the world.
I'm going to stay with you, Ms. Flounders. Over the years, there have been numerous reports about the infiltration of Daesh elements from Syria into Iraq under the protection and logistical assistance of U.S. troops, the Popular Mobilization Forces and its affiliates, which have been integrated into Iraq's regular forces. They're deployed on the Syrian border, and they're helping the army to stem the movement of the terrorists between the two countries. Do you think maybe that's why they're being targeted by the U.S.?
Well, certainly the U.S. wants to continue to use Daesh forces. They want to use everywhere they can the most reactionary forces who only seek to destroy. And it, in the same way that their alliances are with completely criminal monarchies who don't represent the population, such as Saudi Arabia. So it's not surprising that they would use Daesh, ISIS forces in Iraq, in Syria, and use as a threatening force in other countries of the world, and then it gives them an excuse to say they're going in to fight these forces. Well, maybe folks bought that back in 2014 and 2015, but I don't think anybody accepts that any longer. They know who pays and who transports these forces, who protects them in supposed prisons, and then moves them out in order to carry out destruction again.
Sure. One last question for Daniel Kovalik in Pittsburgh, Syria's new permanent representative to the UN, Bassam Sapo. He stressed that the politicization of the Syrian humanitarian crisis has increased the suffering of people in the war-ravaged country, and Western sanctions against his country have prevented Syrians from acquiring their basic commodities. Why are Syrians being collectively punished by Western countries, namely the U.S.?
Well, this is standard operating procedure. Many countries are being punished. Many populations are being punished by the West, and in particular by the U.S., because they are standing firm against U.S. aggression, against U.S. intervention, against U.S. imperialism. And when you do that, you're punished. That is how it goes. That's how the U.S. has operated since its inception. That is the nature of the beast, unfortunately.
All right. Thank